Good morning and welcome to session 224, Monogamy Underground and the Burial of a Plural Marriage in Joseph and Emma Smith's Graves. If you would turn off your cell phones or put them on vibrate, that would be great. And except for that, we don't have any other announcements. I'll just go ahead and introduce the speaker. This is Lee Wiles, and he's a PhD student at the in comparative studies at the at Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. And he doesn't have any other information on here. And I asked him if he wanted me to announce anything else. He said he'd like me to announce that he won a gold medal at the Olympics once.
So. I didn't, actually.
And that he's thinking maybe he should flesh out this bio with, you know, just make stuff up. So
right.
I think making stuff up for your own bio as an introduction at a conference is okay. What's not okay is to make up stuff for your presentation. So we trust that he's not going to do that, and we'll turn the time over to him.
I did it all in the bio. Okay. Okay. So let's hope everything works out technically here. So a few introductory remarks. So this is taken from a longer paper, so I've left out some of the details, so hopefully you'll forgive me for that. It seems like I'm just glossing over something. And this is based on archival research that I've done at a few archives. It's also based on fieldwork, ethnographic fieldwork, that I did during the summer of 2011 when I actually lived in Nauvoo. I was a historical fellow and also a guide at the Joseph Smith Historic Site at the properties. So in addition to doing my ethnographic research there, I was also a guide. So I took people through the Joseph Smith properties, through the homestead, through the mansion house, the red brick store, and I also had the opportunity to field questions and comments almost on a daily basis over about 10 weeks at the Smith family cemetery, so at the graves of Joseph and Hiram and Emma. So some of my work is based on that. Now, there are, just to warn you, there are a few long sentences right at the beginning, also some in the middle of the paper. I put those on the slide so you could read along with me. Hopefully that makes it a little bit easier. There's also a timeline in the presentation. I'll be skipping around from different time periods throughout, so I think that, again, that'll help everyone follow along as I do that. And finally, just in case not everyone knows this, I'm going to be referring quite a bit to the LDS Church and also the RLDS/Community of Christ, and I'm going to be using the term Mormon at different points. And whenever I use the term Mormon, that's going to be referring exclusively to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and it won't apply to the RLDS Church of the Community of Christ. So, with that, I'll go ahead and get started. We've got quite a bit of ground to cover here. Okay, so the mortal remains of Emma, Joseph, and Hiram Smith have received a great deal more attention than is typical of dead bodies. As theirs are the remains of prominent leaders of the early Latter-day Saint movement, they have generated an interest in their whereabouts, desires to find them, a will to move them and to memorialize and represent them in particular ways. Catherine Verity's work in the political lives of dead bodies and Michael Kamen's Digging Up the Dead have inspired and informed this essay and its focus on the locations, arrangements, ownership, and memorializations of Joseph Hiram and Emma Smith's remains as they fit into a broader historical matrix of knowledge about, attention toward, investment in, effacement of, and conflict concerning Joseph and Emma's views of and practices related to plural marriage. Though it was not my intent to do so, at the start of this project, Emma has emerged at the center of the analysis that follows. In that respect, this study of the history of Joseph Hiram and Emma's bodies will be unique. It was by means of close attention to the movements of Emma's remains through their post-mortal existence that the following essay took shape. Ultimately, I will explore some of the ways in which the normative vantage points from which members of the LDS Church and the RLDS Church / Community of Christ, as it's been known since 2001, interpret and interact with Emma, Joseph, and Hiram's gravesite, have moved into alignment in the 20th and 21st centuries, and the reasons for and effects for that alignment. So that's one of the big sentences out of the way. Section 1, Elect Ladies. On May 2, 1879, the deceased body of the woman who had been born Emma Hale, was buried in a gentle slope just a few hundred feet from the Mississippi River on the southern end of a peninsula that had from the late 1830s to the mid-1840s been the bustling heart of Nauvoo, Illinois, whose inhabitants at its peak numbered approximately 12,000. The land in which Emma was interred had been in her family since the community's heyday. But by 1879, it sat amidst the quiet ruins of the old city, most Latter-day Saints having fled in the 1840s either to Utah with Brigham Young or to one of several other communities of saints established throughout the Midwest. At that time, only the village of Nauvoo remained. By the time of her death, Emma was known by several names, Mrs. Biteman, Emma Smith, and Emma Smith Biteman among them. Everyone in her acquaintance, however, also knew her as the former wife of the prophet Joseph Smith. Emma had married Joseph Smith Jr. in January of 1827 at the age of 22 and was soon to become a central figure of the religious drama of Mormonism's early history. At the time of Joseph's assassination in June of 1844, she was also his only publicly acknowledged wife. She had certainly been his first and had lived through several periods of hardship due to her relationship with Joseph and his role as the founder of a new religious movement. Yet Emma's devotion to Joseph did not extend to an acceptance of plural marriage. After Joseph's death, she denounced those who taught that her husband had been secretly married to multiple women. As the Latter-day Saint movement fragmented, Emma stayed behind in Nauvoo with her children and her mother-in-law. She quickly became an opponent of Brigham Young. In December of 1847, Young became head of the new LDS First Presidency, meaning he was Joseph Smith's successor in the eyes of his supporters. Though it was not until 1852 that the LDS Church openly announced its practice of the principle, the followers of Young had been sanctioning new plural marriages since before their departure from Nauvoo. In the same month that the LDS designated Brigham Young as Smith's successor, Emma married Major Lewis Biteman, one of Nauvoo's new citizens, as they were called, and a non-Latter-day Saint who had supported the residents of the city during their armed confrontations in the mid-1840s. More than a decade later, in 1860, when her oldest son, Joseph Smith III, agreed to be ordained prophet of a reorganized church, Emma joined him. The new Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or RLDS, was an amalgamation of many groups and individuals that had not followed Brigham Young for various reasons. Several early individuals that had not followed, several early leaders of the RLDS Church attested that Joseph Smith Jr. had taught the principle of plural marriage, yet all rejected it as a valid part of the Restoration. Joseph Smith III, however, used his position as prophet to both reject polygamy and to deny that his father had advocated or practiced it. As an ardent proponent of her son's position, Emma's image among the RLDS of the 19th century was that of a beacon of truth. Among the LDS of Utah, however, she was seen as a fallen elect lady, quote unquote. A few weeks after Emma's death, Elder Mark Forskett of the RLDS Church gave a commemorative discourse in Plato, Illinois. Speaking of Emma's surviving second husband, Elder Forskett commented that often have I thought of his strong denunciation of some in Utah who maligned her because she opposed what she believed to be the inequities of their system, unquote. System being a euphemism here for plural marriage. During Forskett's lengthy sermon, he several times referred to Emma as the elect lady, and after alluding indirectly to plural marriage repeatedly, he commented rather forcefully on the matter, that she was not, quote, that she was not in sympathy with the policy of the church which now exists in Utah is a matter of history, but that she ever denied any portion of the great work of God, none will be able to prove. With polygamy and all its kindred evils, she was ever in deadly warfare, even down to the time of her death. Meanwhile, in Utah, the LDS Church was disturbed by Emma's denials that her husband practiced and taught plural marriage. In response to what was known as Emma's last testimony concerning polygamy, Eliza R. Snow, about whom more will be said below, wrote, "I once dearly loved Sister Emma, and now, for me to believe that she, a once honored woman, should have sunk so low as to deny what she knew to be true, seems a palpable absurdity. What purports to be her last testimony was really her testimony. She died with a libel on her lips, a libel against her husband, against his wives, against the truth, and a libel against God. The author signed her letter, Eliza R. Snow, a wife of Joseph Smith, the prophet. Furthermore, Emma's obituary in the Deseret News stated that her opposition to the doctrine of plural marriage, which, however, she had first embraced, led to her departure from the faith of the gospel as revealed through her martyred husband. She chose to remain at Nauvoo when the saints left for the West, and in consequence lost the honor and glory that might have crowned her brow as the elect lady. An example that provides a stark contrast to the LDS Church's response to Emma's death in 1879 is the praise that was bestowed upon Eliza R. Snow Smith when she passed away in late 1887. Eliza was a prominent member of Mormon society, both in Nauvoo and later in Utah. She had long attested that she had been a plural wife of Joseph Smith during the last 2 years of his life. Her funeral, much like the news of Emma's death, was used as an opportunity to propagandize in support of polygamy. Eliza had herself been one of the foremost proponents of plural marriage, and her death came during a time of enormous challenges. Only 3 years later, in 1890, President Wilford Woodruff issued the first anti-polygamy manifesto. But in 1887, the effort to promote polygamy in defiance of federal law was going strong, and Eliza's funeral provided an occasion to reassert that Mormon plural marriage originated with the church's founder, Joseph Smith Jr. Elder Joseph B. Noble, one of the speakers at Eliza's memorial service, imagined her sweet reunion with Joseph Smith in the afterlife. The hour draws nigh, quote, "the hour draws nigh when she will hear the voice of her sleeping companion, him who laid down his life for the cause of God and shed his blood for the same," unquote. The author of her obituary wrote that, quote, "she has gone to mingle with the righteous who have kept the faith, to associate with her husband the great prophet of the last dispensation, to whom she has shown a sublime devotion that will be appreciated in the eternities to come," unquote. And again, her intimate association with Joseph the seer, the obituary writer explains, ripened into a holy consummation, and she in the year 1843 became his wife in accordance with the sacred ordinance of heaven and the direct command of God to her husband. She thus became one of the first women of this dispensation to enter the sacred and divine order of plural marriage, unquote. The author concludes by claiming that it, quote, "may be said concerning her that she was indeed an elect lady," unquote. A statement that certainly few Latter-day Saint readers would understand as anything other than an attempt to assert that Eliza had supplanted Emma as the First Lady of Mormonism. In fact, throughout the compiled record of Eliza's funeral service, she is referred to by the name Eliza R. Snow Smith, and it's difficult to see here, but maybe some of you have visited the site here in Salt Lake City, but it also appears on her tombstone. Eliza was buried close to Brigham Young here in Salt Lake, to whom she was sealed to for a time after Joseph's death, but her spirit and her resurrected tabernacle, according to LDS narratives of the time, would be with Joseph Smith, whose body at that point in history lay in a location known to very few. Section 2, The Martyrs. On June 27, 1844, the brothers Joseph and Hiram Smith were killed in Carthage, Illinois. Their bodies were brought back to Nauvoo the next day, and under the cover of darkness on June 29th, buried secretly. At some point a few months later, the bodies were disinterred and moved. By some accounts, they were moved on multiple occasions. In others, they were moved but one time between 1844 and 1928. Regardless, the paramount concern of Emma was secrecy. She feared the bodies would be desecrated. In fact, the secret of the body's location was being kept not only from non-saints, but also the vast majority of Latter-day Saints as well. It seemed that Emma may have even tried to keep the secret of the first move from Hiram's public wife, Mary Fielding Smith, one of three he purportedly had at the time of his death. Though Mary did apparently know the resting, the new resting place of her dead husband, when she, her children, and her sister wives left Nauvoo in 1846, they did so without his body. Thus it was that until 1928, the bodies remained unmemorialized in Nauvoo, and their exact location was kept a guarded secret known to but a few individuals inside the Smith family, though many outside the family seem to have had a general knowledge of the location. The 1928 memorialization of Joseph, Hiram, and Emma, however, had its roots in discussions going back nearly three decades. All this activity occurred, moreover, in a span of time that cultural historian Michael Kamen describes as a particularly active period for reburials of notable individuals in the United States more generally. In August of 1900, J.W. White, a leader in the RLDS Church, began advocating publicly for improvements to the area around the location where he believed the graves of Joseph and Hiram were located. White's comments regarding the unsatisfactory state of the site, which he described as being overgrown and as home to barnyard animals, was influenced by sentiments that had certainly been molded by nearly a century's worth of American cemetery movements, all of which sought to beautify and protect places of interment. Such a condition would not have been as alarming, or would have been very unlikely to have been as alarming to observers 100 years earlier. A few months after White's comments, Joseph Smith III, in response, noted that he would be supportive of such improvements. He wrote that the passing of time may have made it safe to publicly acknowledge his father and uncle's place of burial. In 1907, a committee on the Monument to the Martyrs, as it was called after 1909, was established to oversee the project. Other than acquiring the burying grounds from the Smith family, little progress was made by the committee during the following years. Joseph Smith III passed away in 1914, and by 1917, the Laurel Club of Independence had managed to raise funds for the erection of a sarcophagus to house his remains. That achievement was used as leverage to spur RLDS members to action for the building of a monument to Joseph and Hiram. In a Saints Herald article noting the accomplishment, President Fred M. Smith's wife asked, quote, "When will the graves be marked?" unquote. Nonetheless, as of the start of 1928, the bodies still had not been exhumed or memorialized. In fact, searches of relevant documents reveal no evidence that there were plans among RLDS leadership prior to mid-1927, so just 6 months or so before the bodies were actually exhumed. So there is no evidence that prior to mid-1927 that the leadership, RLDS leadership, planned to exhume the bodies of Joseph and Hiram, nor to include Emma in the Monument to the Martyrs. Rather, plans were to memorialize Joseph and Hiram at the place that had been designated as their location of burial in Smith family tradition. It may have been due to the influence of a Kansas City surveyor named W.O. Hands that plans were first made to exhume Joseph and Hiram's bodies. Hands, in 1920, traveled to Nauvoo to look into the condition of RLDS church land. Water had continued to rise for several years after the installation of a dam on the Mississippi River in 1913, and church property was sinking below the developing lake. At that time, Hands began to inquire among locals about the place of Joseph and Hiram's graves. Finding no satisfactory answers at that time, he returned in 1924. Quote, "I visited a number of old Nauvoo citizens," he wrote, "and among other things, they told me that elders from the Utah church had assured them that the bodies of the martyrs were under a monument in Salt Lake City," unquote. In August of 1927, Hands traveled to Nauvoo with President Fred M. Smith to investigate further. At that time, they apparently made the decision to attempt exhumations at some later date in order to explore whether family memory regarding the graves' locations was accurate. After the bodies were found early the next year, President Smith, Fred M. Smith, explained the two main reasons for the search. One, to put the rest to rest rumors as to their whereabouts, that's a quote, presumably including rumors that the bodies were taken to Utah, and two, to erect a monument on the exact spot where the remains lie, which was apparently an important goal. Certainly the rising water was also a factor, considering that it had been a concern of the Committee on the Monument to the Martyrs for years, and that the first location which the search team dug was very near the rising water line. Regardless, records still reveal no indication that Emma's remains would be sought. Yet in January of 1928, after W. O. Hand's team had trenched for several days to no avail in the spot where they thought the bodies were interred, they turned to Emma's crypt, as it's called in the notes from the time, which they believed marked her place of burial. They thus moved a few dozen feet north and up the slight slope overlooking the Mississippi. Section 3, Emma's Cenotaph and the Mortal Remains. At some point within a few years of Emma's death in 1879, a brick vault, and I apologize for the quality of the picture here, a brick vault with a slanted marble slab laying across the top was constructed above ground as a memorial to her. According to one tradition, Emma had requested that she be buried in a specific location that was thought to be near the spot of Joseph's secret grave. Hand's team thus decided to first search for Emma and then to trench around her burial plot for Joseph and Hiram, They found, however, that Emma was not underneath the vault, meaning that the monument was in fact a cenotaph. Gina Alden explains that two speculative theories developed in future years. Some believe that, quote, the marker was placed at a later date and her exact burial place was forgotten. Others felt that perhaps family members were still keeping the secret. Hoping that Emma's body might be nearby, Hans T. began trenching to the east. Fewer than 3 feet away, they located and identified Emma's remains. Continuing from there, they dug south. But quote, we found nothing except the grave of Louis Biedemann, which lay immediately south of the Emma crypt, unquote. After several more days of frustrated digging, Hans writes that he felt inspiration to have a trench dug just a few feet from the one in which the team found Emma. There they encountered a foundation wall that, according to family tradition, matched the one in which the bodies of Joseph and Hiram had been hidden. Within, they found the partial remains of two skeletons that they identified as those of the Smith brothers. It was after the fortuitous discovery of Emma and the following unearthing of Joseph and Hiram that the decision was made to exhume all three bodies and to reinter them side by side. The day the Smith brothers' skeletal remains were found, W. Hans telegraphed RLDS church leadership in Independence, Missouri to give them the news. On the day following, Hans telegraphed again to confirm the find, indicating, quote, we here all think Emma should be placed beside Joseph, unquote. Hans later explained that upon the arrival of Fred M. Smith in Nauvoo on January 19th, he and those who traveled with him approved the location and design of a new memorial that would, quote, contain the remains of not only Joseph and Hiram, but Emma, it being the opinion of the Nauvoo saints and the general church officials that the sacrifice which she made before and after the death of her husband entitled her to the same respect that was shown the martyrs, unquote. Thus, the three bodies were disinterred and placed in adjacent wood boxes, which were then encased in concrete, into which three marble markers were embedded. You can see them here, each placed directly above one of the bodies. Names and titles for the deceased individuals were etched into their respective marble slabs. Hiram, the patriarch, Joseph, the prophet, and Emma, wife of Joseph Smith. The new concrete base was to serve as a foundation for a larger monument that, according to a source in Nauvoo, I've now been able to connect this quote with Fred M. Smith, would, quote, be a landmark visible for miles up and down the Mississippi River between Keokuk and Fort Madison, unquote. The removal of Emma from the grave, in which she had laid for almost 50 years, and her subsequent entombment beside Joseph could be explained simply by reference to predominant trends of American burial in the early 20th century, by which spouses were laid to rest and memorialized side by side in a fashion identical to today's custom. It is typical, after all, for kin to be situated near one another within cemeteries and burial grounds, with bonds of marriage receiving primacy above other relationships. It is, in fact, this tradition that establishes the performative frame in which Joseph and Emma's positioning and memorialization in 1928 is easily and seemingly naturally legible as signifying their bonds as husband and wife, even without descriptive text. Yet, this interment and memorialization occurred at the nexus of a religious struggle over the heritage of Joseph Smith's teachings and practices regarding plural marriage, and is imbued with public meanings that transcend their significance as part of broader trends by which specific families symbolize the relationship between dead spouses by burying them side by side. The movement of Emma and Joseph's remains and their memorialization in 1928 facilitated the emergence of Joseph's dead body as situated in a monogamous marriage with Emma, to be gazed upon primarily by members of the Latter-day Saint churches in the midst of competing narratives regarding the extent to which the relationship was exclusive. Furthermore, Joseph's place next to Hiram indexes their role as martyrs. In fact, W.O. Hans' design for the memorial included the unused label, the Martyry. Positioning Emma within the memorial to the martyrs gives the impression that she also was a martyr for the movement. Within the RLDS Church at the time, public memory of her role was one of an anti-polygamy crusader. That fact, in addition to her placement next to Joseph, concretized in a material form the exclusiveness of her relationship with Joseph and her role as a martyr in the crusade against polygamy, equal in status and allied with her husband and his brother Hiram, allowing Emma to continue her anti-polygamy campaign from the grave. As an RLDS writer once described her, quote, she was dead yet speaketh. The relative safety of revealing the burial location of Joseph and Hiram that Joseph Smith III acknowledged in 1900 made possible the emergence in 1928 of a physical object directly indexing the location of Joseph and Hiram's Emma's bodies, in which they could be gazed upon as a monogamous couple, Emma to be gazed upon as Joseph's wife and Joseph as her husband. The original plans for the monument, sans Emma, incorporated conceptually the emergence of Joseph and Hiram as dead bodies that could finally be recognized as respected public leaders after a long period of ignominious hiding. But that concept, while not fully supplanted, was made supplemental to Joseph's emergence from hiding to be gazed upon as a truly monogamous public figure, contrary to the teachings of the 19th century LDS Church. Section 4, Realigning Emma. The enablement of this gaze required the twin symbolic gestures of effacing Emma's marriage to her second husband, Louis Weideman, and connecting her exclusively with Joseph Smith. As mentioned above, Emma was known by several names in later life. The name etched into the marble slab on the monument placed soon after her death read Emma Smith Weideman, reflecting her successive marriages to Joseph Smith Jr. and Louis Weideman. Major Weideman, after all, was married to Emma for over 30 years and helped raise the children whose biological father was Joseph Smith. Louis was also a well-known figure in and around Nauvoo, thus Emma Stone bore his surname. When in 1928 W. O. Hands reinterred Emma, Joseph, and Hiram, however, the three marble slabs he placed above them were made from the marble of Emma's cenotaph. The marble had been lifted from its brick base, flipped, cut into three pieces, etched with new text, and embedded into the concrete of the monument to the martyrs. Thus, the materialized connection to Louis Weideman that had literally been carved in stone as part of Emma's original memorial was fragmented and buried in concrete. The description of Emma on her new monument, Emma, wife of Joseph Smith, omitted her ties to Lewis and in fact made her relevance to the monument and as a personality in general, contingent upon her marriage bonds with Joseph Smith. The symbolic distancing of Emma from Louis Weideman had actually begun years earlier. Already in Forskett's commemorative discourse, which as described above was delivered just a few weeks after Emma's death, RLDS memory was conforming to a pattern in which Louis Weideman's 32 plus years of marriage to Emma were overshadowed by her much shorter marriage to Joseph. Forskett comments at length on the relationship and their ordeals together, dedicating only a few comments to Major Weideman. Even in W. Hand's description of his unearthing of Emma's Weideman's body, he shows no enthusiasm, writing, quote, again, "We found nothing except the grave of Louis Weideman," unquote, as though it were simply a stumbling block to more worthy discoveries. When Emma's body was located in 1928, it was only 3 or 4 feet from Weideman, and his body was buried immediately adjacent to Emma's cenotaph. Weideman passed away in 1891, and it seems reasonable that it was someone's intention to bury him next to the woman with whom he had spent much of his adult life. Regardless, the location of Emma's burial was interpreted in 1928 as expressive of an intent to inter her as close as possible to Joseph, this despite the fact that her remains were several feet from him and were actually closer to Weideman's body. Whatever Weideman's wishes or those of the people who buried him had been were entirely ignored. It is more than plausible, and in my longer paper I draw this argument at some length, that Joseph Smith III himself chose the location of Weideman's interment. Tendencies to dismiss Louis Weideman are notable across the historic record. For the most part, Wright, Newell, and Avery, RLDS historians and writers have ignored Louis Weideman's existence. Among LDS writers, vilification of Louis Weideman easily became a subtle means of establishing that something must have been wrong with Emma Smith, unquote. Even today, Louis Weideman's grave remains unmarked, though that is not atypical for the Smith family burying ground. Most of the bodies remain unmarked. What seems more peculiar, however, is that, and I wish I had a laser pointer here, that on a plaque near the center of the cemetery that is embossed with the names of Smith family members and friends, all of whom were interred there after Joseph and Hiram's secret burial, Lewis is listed near the bottom as an other. So you can probably see this the second down under other, meaning non-kin. This despite the fact that he was husband to Emma and stepfather to her children and she stepmother to his. For 3 decades. The enablement of the gaze in which Joseph and Emma's bodies could be viewed through their memorials as monogamous public figures also required the twin symbolic gesture, through which Emma could be exclusively tied to Joseph Smith. The means by which this was done in the material form of the monument have already been discussed. Yet there were grander plans in store to make the monogamy-promoting theme of the monument more explicit. On a loose sheet of paper within a stack of documents, one of which is signed by President Fred M. Smith, and all of which seem to be in his handwriting, this from the Community of Christ archives, his text that appears to be for the monument that RLDS leaders had planned to erect on the concrete foundation laid at the site of Joseph, Hiram, and Emma's reinterment in 1928. The text reads, quote, "Here below in crypts of artificial stone are the remains of Joseph and Hiram Smith, brothers in the flesh and workers together in life, both killed June 27, 1844. Besides Joseph are the remains of his faithful and only wife, Emma, who died on, 1879. I think you need to go back to his notes for the date," end quote. Though the grand monument as imagined in 1928 never materialized in the way that it was imagined at the time, President Smith's plans are revealing of the meanings inscribed in the memorial as it took shape in 1928 and the ideological features of the monument as it evolved in subsequent years. Furthermore, tour guides reinforce these inscribed features in future years. Tours during the tenure of James Page, who is the RLDS caretaker of historic sites in Nauvoo in the late 1930s, early 40s, and possibly beyond, began at the grave sites, which they don't today, if any of you have been there. The first sentence of one script written by James Page, he wrote, quote, "You are the graves of Joseph Smith, his only wife Emma, and his brother Hiram," unquote. In another script, perhaps written just a few years later, Page goes into more detail concerning Joseph's monogamy. "Here are the graves of the martyrs. Joseph Smith in the center, his brother who was murdered with him at the right, and his devoted wife at left. Here, frequently, someone says," and I wonder who these people were asking the question, "but his first wife or which wife? In that case, we very clearly state the only wife the man ever had. It is peculiar, isn't it, to see how much incorrect information is extant in the world." This is probably my favorite quote from the research for this paper. "It is surprisingly strange that people should have been so incorrectly informed when Joseph Smith himself taught clearer on marriage than any man who has ever lived in the history of the world." On October 25th, 1951, the three marble slabs that were embedded into concrete over Joseph, Hiram, and Emma's bodies in 1928 were removed. And a single large granite slab, and again I apologize for the quality of this picture, was placed over the top of all three graves. The monikers and roles of all three remained the same on the new memorial, and thus the ideological features inscribed in the 1928 monument remained. Additional text was added to describe the purpose and ownership of the monument. The text along the top read, "In memory of Joseph Smith, who translated the Book of Mormon on April 6, 1830, organized the Church of Jesus Christ." On bottom was etched, a quote, "erected and maintained by the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, 1951. Thus, the RLDS Church's control of the bodies was displayed prominently for all visitors to see. Section 5, LDS effacement of plural marriage and the reclamation of Emma. Whereas our LDS guides in Nauvoo might have continued to believe at mid-century that their assertions of the exclusiveness of Joseph and Emma's marriage were in opposition to active LDS teachings, it is likely that many LDS visitors' imaginings of Joseph and Emma's relationship were actually in alignment with those of their RLDS hosts. Whatever interest LDS visitors to Nauvoo in the late 19th or early 20th centuries might have had in challenging RLDS assertions that Joseph never practiced or taught plural marriage, those had most likely diminished by mid-20th century, if not already by 1928 when the first memorial was erected. Much had changed in LDS attitudes toward plural marriage since Eliza R. Snow Smith's funeral in 1887. By the middle of the 20th century, Mormons had revolutionized their own approach to the law of marriage and were emerging as defenders of the traditional family, writes Sarah Baron Gordon. In many big and small ways, the historical traces of plural marriage were supplanted in LDS memory, and I've left out all the examples here. The historian of Mormonism, Davis Bitten, noted that, quote, "By mid-20th century, the visual representations of Mormon history numbered in the thousands, all contributing to the process of ritualization by establishing a sense of the past that was primarily emotional, appropriable, and not primarily concerned with accuracy. Accurate or inaccurate, it was certainly selective. There are, for example," and this is one example, "no marble monuments to polygamy." Also, in contrast to the attitudes of late 19th century Mormons, Emma is no longer condemned by the LDS as a denier of her husband's teachings regarding plural marriage. In fact, since at least the mid-20th century, she has been valorized as an adoring wife. From prominently placed statuary that features Joseph and Emma looking lovingly into each other's eyes, to pageantry such as the live-action historical vignette in Nauvoo titled Letters of Joseph and Emma, which you can see there on the lower left-hand side, of Letters of Emma and Joseph, sorry, to LDS-themed movies such as Emma Smith, My Story, Emma has been salvaged in LDS memory as the epitome of graceful womanliness. She's become an example for all Mormon women to follow. While Joseph's plural marriages are not denied by the LDS Church, knowledge of such marriages has been marginalized in Mormon memory, and despite occasional mentions, nearly entirely effaced in LDS presentations of his life. The fading from memory of the LDS Church's full-throated assertions of Joseph's engagement in plural marriage is not, I believe, an active forgetting, but more of a passive forgetting by omission, at least in the way it plays out in most Mormons' lives. The record of such assertions largely disappeared from the LDS record. Thus, knowledge of Joseph's plural marriages and the LDS Church's position regarding them is likely not part of the active memory of most LDS visitors to Nauvoo, even if it is sometimes part of their overall store of knowledge. To give an extreme example to illustrate a point, the effacement of plural marriage in the LDS past is so thorough that some Mormons believe it was in fact the RLDS Church that practiced polygamy, while the LDS Church crusaded against it. I know that's sort of an extreme example, but I have encountered a number of times that would have been impossible in the 19th century. So, section 6, the LDS return to Nauvoo. While Mormons had been visiting Nauvoo individually and in groups since the exodus of 1845 and 46, the trickle became a steady stream after 1962, when Nauvoo Restoration, Inc., in tandem with the growth of the heritage industry in the United States as a whole, began to purchase and restore historic properties in order to establish an LDS presence in the Old City. Nauvoo became a major Mormon tourist destination as the LDS footprint grew over the next few decades. Thousands of Mormons from all over the world visit each year. The north side of Nauvoo's peninsula, or the LDS side of town, has become a site of material history in which the many lessons Mormons have learned about their past are supplemented and augmented by their experiences in a zone that is imbued with an enhanced representativeness of that past. Mormons' knowledge of and feel for their history are mediated by the context of the city, complete with restored and reconstructed period buildings, missionary guides in historic dress, and tour scripts that present faith-promoting corporate and individual narratives set within Nauvoo during its heyday. In Nauvoo, Mormons are induced to feel that they partially access and share in the LDS past in a more direct way than is available through other mediums, such as books, pamphlets, videos, etc., by which the church instructs members and non-members about its history. At LDS historic sites, visitors hear brief and by modern historical standards sanitized and idealized narratives of life in Nauvoo from costume missionary interpreters. These lessons then build into testimonies in which missionary interpreters draw connections between their faith and the lives and struggles of Mormons in the Nauvoo of the 1830s and 40s. The residents of Old Nauvoo, in the idealized form in which they are presented, are exemplars of the way Mormons today should behave. Mormon visitors are suddenly encouraged to live by their example, to replicate their morality, faith, and loyalty. As the character of Parley P. Pratt says near the beginning of the annual and well-attended Nauvoo pageant, quote, "When you're here, we're here." The gravesite of Joseph, Hiram, and Emma, though it is owned by the RLDS Church, or the Community of Christ, which changed its name to Community of Christ in 2001, also called the Community of Christ the CFC from here on out, becomes part of this matrix of knowledge production, a site of materialized punctuation of LDS historical lessons and memory. The RLDS or CFC's emphasis on Joseph and Emma's relationship, as it appears in the Smith Family Cemetery, framed in terms of idealized monogamy, is harmonious with the effacement of polygamy in the Nauvoo pageant and at LDS historic sites. When women who are likely plural wives of Joseph Smith or other church leaders are discussed or displayed in images in the restored homes and businesses of LDS Nauvoo, their role as plural wives is not mentioned. In addition, when characters of women who are plural wives of Joseph appear in live-action vignettes that accompany the Nauvoo pageant, they are not presented as such. that aspect of the relationship with Joseph is ignored. The present is far from the days in which these women, such as Eliza R. Snow, whose character does appear in at least one vignette, were lauded by Mormons as some of the first women to practice plural marriage in this dispensation. So you could just imagine if the Nauvoo pageant were happening in the 19th century, how these women would be presented as opposed to how they're presented today. Plural wives are also not part of the standard narrative of COC sites, including that portion of the tour concerning the cemetery. Though it's now official policy of the Community of Christ to no longer assert the historicity of Joseph and Emma's monogamous relationship, polygamy-effacing features are still prevalent in the tour, both narratively and materially. Those features reinforce idealized and sanitized LDS framings of life in Nauvoo. Mormon monogamous lives today are reinforced, though mostly unintentionally, as much by COC idealizations of the monogamous past as they are by LDS presentations. The memorial to Joseph, Hiram, and Emma is a physical materialization of the confluence of historical RLDS or CFC and current LDS idealizations of the monogamous past of their founder. Of course, tension still often exists between LDS visitors and the Community of Christ material and oral interpretations. Despite the frequent confluence of LDS and CFC presentations of Nauvoo history as it regards plural marriage, the vast majority of tour guests and visitors to the graves are LDS. The historical animosities between the two churches and their continuing and expanding differences contribute to a critical suspicion on the part of many LDS visitors when they visit CFC sites. LDS visitors interpret what they hear, see, and feel at CFC sites with an attentiveness to their understandings of LDS and RLDS or CFC relations. In other words, LDS visitors are often slightly, on rare occasions, aggressively guarded. They are aware that partisan interpretations could be foisted upon them in the guise of a neutral-sounding historical interpretation or presentation. As mentioned above, the 1951 granite monument placed at the gravesite of the martyrs prominently bore the text, quote, erected and maintained by the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, unquote. That monument's face is no longer visible. It is almost certain, however, that the text put LDS visitors on guard. Though I have nothing but impressionistic evidence to support the claim, it is likely that regardless of whether LDS visitors encountered the text on an RLDS tour or by entering the memorial area without a guide, it enhanced their critical attentiveness to RLDS messaging that might undermine their knowledge of and feelings about versions of Latter-day Saint history in which they were invested. Regardless, they would likely not have encountered anything that ran counter to their understanding of Joseph and Emma's marriage. Even in cases in which knowledge of Joseph's plural marriages was active in LDS visitors' minds during their trip to RLDS properties, that knowledge often would not interfere with their appreciation of the memorial as expressing the perceived unique qualities of Joseph and Emma's romantic and companion relationship. It would seem natural, in other words, that Joseph and Emma would be buried side by side. That fact would not on its own be cause for enhanced suspicion that RLDS ideology inhered in the monogamous design of the memorial. Yet the text of the 1951 monument was a reminder of RLDS presence and control. So section 7, the Smith Family Cemetery today. In 1991, the granite monument that stands over Joseph, Hiram, and Emma's remains today was placed by the Joseph and Hiram Smith Family Foundation. The foundation's members come from several Latter-day Saint churches, including the LDS and CFC. The new monument, which sits atop its predecessor, stands several feet tall at its highest point and is similar in design, if not material, to Emma's long-destroyed cenotaph, though it includes memorials to three individuals rather than one. Buried beneath the new memorial is any mention of ownership by the RLDS Church. Though an interpretive sign outside the fence of the cemetery bears the Community of Christ logo, the grounds themselves are free of such mention. Emma is now etched in stone as, quote, Emma Hale Smith, representing her maiden name and that of her first husband. Her role is, quote, wife of Joseph Smith, Jr., unquote. Other signage also reinforces the exclusiveness of Joseph and Emma's bonds, and there is no mention of her life after his death, during which she crusaded against the LDS Church's practice of plural marriage. She is reclaimed as Joseph's devoted wife, a model for both LDS and CFC members. Though Emma's marriage to Mater Biteman is mentioned on CFC tours today, her ties to Lewis remain severed entirely at the cemetery. His role in Emma's life is nowhere to be found. The elision of Major Biteman's relationship with Emma unintentionally enables LDS projects that efface the time frame in which she was staunchly anti-Brigham Young and anti-plural marriage. It allows her to be bound to periods of her life when she was married to Joseph Smith, when plural marriage was practiced in secret and not reflected in Joseph and Emma's public life beyond a small circle of male associates and other plural wives. In other words, when Mormon memory of Emma is isolated to her life with Joseph, it is easier to ignore her status in the RLDS Church and her opposition to the LDS hierarchy. Thus, the RLDS decision in 1928 to exhume and rememorialize Emma removed a stumbling block to LDS reclamations of Emma as Joseph's companion, as the elect lady. Since the Community of Christ's presence today is absent from the text of the monument itself, LDS visitors can identify with it more fully. Critical suspicion of the type that was likely aroused for many LDS visitors by the text of the 1951 monument may dwell with them in the cemetery to some extent, but it is not elicited by the monument itself nor by the surrounding signage. Thus, the monument and the environment of the burying ground are better able to reinforce LDS effacement of Joseph's plural marriages or marginalization of the memory of Joseph's plural marriages without interference by critical attention to any RLDS or CFC ideology that might be installed in the cemetery itself. Furthermore, the extent to which the LDS have effaced Joseph's plural marriages and the church's one strong advocacy on behalf of remembering those marriages can be observed in the absence of any mention of plural wives, even though Mormons have for more than two decades had some influence over the design of the memorial and the interpretive displays on cemetery property. The Smith Family Burying Ground today is a site at which CFC and LDS members' interpretations of their past as they relate to polygamy, specifically, can coalesce more comfortably than ever, even if the nexus of idealized monogamy rests at intersections between very different institutional histories, theological understandings, and claims to truth of the two churches. Remaining areas of contestation and disagreement are downplayed. As Catherine Verdery has written, quote, "A dead body's symbolic effectiveness does not depend on its standing for one particular thing. For among the most important properties of bodies is their ambiguity, multivocality, and polysemy. For among the most important, I already read that, remains are concrete yet protean. They do not have a single meaning, but are open to many different readings," unquote. The monument to the martyrs is not univocal. It is inscribed with monogamy-promoting features by way of repeated human interaction, a broader semiotic field, and a dense history of design, by which the RLDS Church's intent in the early 20th century to deny Joseph Smith's practice of plural marriage and the LDS Church's more recent marginalization of the memory of its own polygamous past are reinforced. Nonetheless, the monument is not limited to only expressing its view on the question of marriage. LDS and CFC visitors today still have very different understandings of the roles and lives of the people buried there, and many of those varied understandings are allowed to flourish at the site without active contestation. Joseph can be the first prophet of the LDS Church and of the Community of Christ. Emma can be the anti-polygamy and anti-Brighamite warrior of CFC tradition and the reclaimed elect lady of more recent LDS origin. Both versions of Joseph and Emma are entombed in Nauvoo on a gentle slope just a few feet from the Mississippi River. And that's it.
We have about 11 minutes for questions, so we'll just let Lee.
Should I just start in the front? Yeah.
That was a very good presentation. My question is, when they initially exhume the bodies, is there a detailed description of the condition of bodies, what artifacts were contained within their entombment? And then when they reinterred the bodies, was there another specific description of the condition of bodies, how they prepared them, and what artifacts were transferred originally into the current gravesite?
So for that, I'll refer you to an article written by Barbara Bernauer. It's called Still Side by Side, and she actually details quite a bit of the specifics of what went on during that time. There were actually photographs taken of the remains.
They examined the skulls, and they've done measurements, and there's a book available that has all that in it.
Yeah, not the, so Still Side by Side is sold as a booklet as well. it was published in a journal, I think maybe John Whitmer.
Can you talk into the microphone?
Yeah, sorry about that. I don't know why I stopped doing that. I think it was published in John Whitmer as well, but I'm not certain if that's the journal it was in, the John Whitmer Historical Association Journal. But it's also available as a booklet. So they took photographs at the time, Fred M. Smith, who was the grandson of Joseph Smith Jr., son of Joseph Smith III, prophet of the Reorganized Church at that time, one of these photographs taken, and they were forensic photographs. There were also photographs taken of the reinterment as well, so the way that the bodies were laid out in the boxes. And actually, the LDS Church officials who did come, there were several who drove up from Independence on the morning of the reinterment. So Samuel O'Binion, for example, who was the president of the Central States Mission, LDS Mission at the time, drove up from Independence, sent his reports back to Salt Lake City about what had happened, and everyone was in Salt Lake City, and the LDS representatives from Independence were completely disapproving of the disinterment and the taking of the photographs and the covering of the bodies in concrete, because they were put into boxes and then concrete was just poured over the top, and that was meant to become a base for this new large monument that I was talking about, that Fred M. Smith and other officials had imagined that they might build at the time. Can you hear me whenever I talk at this distance from the microphone? Okay, so I'll lean over like this. Does that answer your question sufficiently?
Any description of artifacts, clothes?
So most of the descriptions of artifacts are emas, like patches of the dress and like a comb and things like that. But you can find a fuller description of that in the Still Side by Side.
No ritual artifacts?
No. Yeah, you're asking about garments?
Well, or any other artifacts associated with masonry or...
No.
Ritual worship.
Nothing like that. I have had a couple of conversations, but it's all speculation. No, there was nothing like that found. Yeah.
Emma was clearly anti-Brigham, but you also mentioned she was a crusader against polygamy.
Yeah.
Other than her 1879 denial, what other published evidence is there that she actually spoke against polygamy or against that it had occurred in Nauvoo?
As far as like published evidence, I would say that the testimony of her children and all of the other people who knew her afterwards, who acknowledged, those who commented on it, not a single, except for one who said that, you know, he thought that she was perhaps admitting that it happened. I think that the testimony of most of the people who encountered her and talked to her about it is pretty strong evidence that she was opposed to it.
Nothing published that we really can put our finger on?
Do you know if there's anything else that's published?
Emma really didn't do a lot of publishing after her move to Fulton City, Whiteside County, Illinois. And as a matter of fact, she intended to evacuate permanently Nauvoo. And when she came back, her focus was on her family. And she really didn't write much. Although the letters that she wrote back and forth to her children are just masterpieces of information and insight.
Yeah. I mean, unless everyone... almost everyone who talked to her about it, you know, is lying, then it seems pretty clear that she was, yeah. Or I'll get to you next.
I just was looking at this book by Willard J. Smith. Joseph Smith, who was he? Did he teach or practice polygamy, and is giving all this evidence and all of this? Is there really any question about whether he taught and practiced polygamy, even though he apparently didn't make public statements to that effect?
I'm not going to comment on that. I don't think it's important for this paper. Yes, I do believe that he did. But I don't think it's important for the points that are being made in this paper whether he actually practiced polygamy or not. Because what's more important for me was the public memory at the time, at these different time periods among these different groups. I think that's what's important for the points that are being made in this paper, talking about collective memory, that rather than the actual historicity of the practice, Joseph's practice of plural marriage. But there were other people who were better qualified to speak on that than I am. Yeah.
You showed an image of a tomb, a big tomb, and you went by it very fast. I'd like to see it again.
That one?
No. It was
Let's see.
Before 1928.
Who did it belong to?
I thought they made it for Joseph Smith to be in. He never was put in there, but.
No,
did I misinterpret that?
Yeah. You may have been. So this is the sarcophagus here that was built.
That's what I'm talking
about. So this was built for Joseph Smith III.
Oh, that's Joseph Smith.
Yeah, and this is in Independence, Missouri. And the only point I was making for that was that Joseph Smith III was originally buried in 1914, then disinterred in 1917, and placed into this sarcophagus whenever it was ready. President Fred M. Smith's wife at the time used this as an opportunity to try to spur the RLDS membership to activity, to try to get them to work harder to build the monument to Joseph and Hiram in Nauvoo.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that for me.
Sure. The tomb, Joseph Johnson has written on that, To Lie in Yonder Tomb is a really good essay on that, Tomb to Joseph, if you'd like to learn more about that.
I've read that, yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, subsequent to 1844, you talk about the LDS Church referring to Emma Smith as the fallen elect lady, and then we talk about the effacement of polygamy by the LDS Church, the reclaiming of Emma as the elect lady. I'm curious about how they deal with Emma's refusal to come west once they go through the effacement of polygamy and reclaiming of Emma as an elect lady.
In a number of different ways. But I don't know whether I'm the best person to speak on that as well. I mean, I could talk about... What's that?
The
question was, I went through this sequence of, after 1844 among the LDS for a period of time, Emma being spoken about in public discourse as sort of a fallen elect lady, right? She's sort of this fallen figure who did not come west, and then thus she's no longer really considered to be in this elect lady status that she had before Joseph's death. I forget the middle part, but then the reclaiming, you said like sort of the effacement of Joseph's practice of plural marriage, and then the reclaiming of Emma. And so then how does the LDS Church deal with Emma not coming west, right? Because there are different things published on this, but what I find most interesting are like the comments that were made in Nauvoo by LDS visitors, right? And this would sometimes come up. I was surprised actually that how infrequently it came up. But a lot of the explanations were like, well, she must have been completely grief stricken. And she can you imagine, like being that grief stricken and then getting in a wagon. And she had to stay and take care of Lucy Mack, who is also sick. So Lucy gets built into the story as she's another. So they sort of build upon one another as reasons to like stay in Nauvoo, because independently of being sick and grief stricken, there really could have been few other motivations. So very uncommonly would someone bring up like her animosity. That was developing at the time towards Brigham. And very, very infrequently would like Mary Fielding Smith, for example, come up as sort of a counterexample of someone who would also have been in the same state of being grief-stricken. Never would any of the plural wives who went to Utah come up as examples of women who were also grief-stricken, who then made the trip to Nauvoo. There are a few, very few accounts of women, some of the plural wives being grief-stricken at the funeral and sort of expressing how they felt. I actually made a note of one. There's a mention of Olive Gray Frost being grief-stricken in Todd Compton's book, too, in her chapter. Give me one second here. I'm going to find this. Oh, here it is. So Emily Dow Partridge, her name is usually given now as Emily Dow Partridge Young. I found at least one document so far where she refers to herself with the surname Smith. But she wrote, quote, in some reminiscences, she wrote, I went with the rest as a stranger, talking about going to the viewing of Joseph's body. I went with the rest as a stranger, none suspecting the extra sorrow that was in my heart. These were sorrowful times. I kind of cannot even now write this without weeping. And that was in 1897 that she wrote that. Yeah.
Had she gone west? Had Emma gone west? And this is completely speculative. But it seems hard to imagine that. Like, what would have been natural, you know, have many of Joseph's wives having been married to Brigham Young after that, or some of the other. Like, would she have gone as a widow? Would she have gone as Brigham's wife? You know, it's just really hard to even imagine that happening. And so,
very unlikely she would have went as Brigham's wife. No.
I mean, you know, how would she have gone as this widow? I mean, it's hard to imagine with what we know of the history now, her place there. So,
right. I don't know how to speculate on that. Someone else, should we start a speculation party on what would have happened if I had gone west? Yeah, I don't know.
I'm wondering if you found any fun anecdotes when they were looking for the bodies that people thought that effort was futile because they assumed you'd been resurrected. Like, there's nothing to look for.
No, not among the RLDS who were looking. I haven't found anything like that. I did not hear. I also interviewed a number of the other Community of Christ guides about the questions they were asked and things like that over the summer. There was an FLDS group that came through that stated that Joseph had been resurrected and then obviously wasn't there. There was, so if you're familiar with James Strang and the Strangite Church, which there are some members of, today, there was one person who came through who thought that the bodies were not there. He didn't know where they were, but he had been told that the bodies of the prophets, their locations are unknown, and thus Joseph fit into that category. That is not a common, as I understand it, Strangite belief. That was just sort of peculiar to him, because others I talked to said
we're out of time. We'll just take one more question. And then if you'd like to trap Lee later, you're welcome.
You can just compete. Just start talking and I'll try to answer both of your questions at the same time.
I'm just going to say that it's very interesting how the LDS Church, the Utah Church, is so strong on and adamant about the polygamy, but over time they have diverged to this deal where they don't mention the other wives and discourses or movies that they produce about Emma and Joseph. I find it very humorous to see that for all their adamant contesting of polygamy, now they try to downplay it.
Right. Yeah, and that is largely the case. And why I'm changing some of the language from complete effacement to sort of marginalization is that there are a few counterexamples. They're not enough for me to say, like, well, the church is acknowledging it and celebrating it, right? That's not happening. But like at the Church History Museum, right? There is the Relief Society display. Is this what?
Yes.
Yeah. So I was really surprised to find this, actually.
I know
this,
one of the docents there, and
really?
I asked her, I said, what is the representation of polygamy at the History Museum, Cultural
right.
and History Museum? She said, there is no representation.
Well, there's one. On the Relief Society wall, on the second floor, when you go up the escalator there, there's these panels of former Relief Society presidents. And, of course, Eliza R. Snow, her name is Eliza R. Snow there, despite her last wishes and the wishes of the last few years of her life to be known as Eliza R. Snow Smith. But it's Eliza R. Snow, and it acknowledges there that she was a plural wife. Well, just, what does it say? It says she was sealed to Joseph and then married for time to Brigham Young. And then Zena D. Huntington also mentions that she was a plural wife of, well, again, it says she was sealed to Joseph. So those are the only two acknowledgments of it. Is
the next project for the Church History Library team after the Joseph Smith papers will be the polygamy papers. So
okay.
This is possibly changing.
Yeah. Yeah. So this may be documenting a historical moment of the LDS Church.
Yeah, and the usage of the term sealed for a non-LDS person, they won't relate to what that even means or represents. So it's, again, a downplaying of what's going on.
Yeah, I wish I don't have the photographs here with me. That's what I remember that it said. And I don't remember if it said sealed for time and eternity or if it just said sealed. Can I do one more question?
You can do one more.
All right, one more question.
Thank you. Lee, I think you made the statement that there are no marble monuments to plural marriage. Did I interpret that correctly?
That's from Davis Bitten.
What about the Brigham Young Cemetery, where there are several wives buried, and there's huge marble slabs, and each one says, wife of Brigham Young.
Right.
Wife of Brigham Young.
Yeah, so I think that he was referring to monuments that had specifically been created during this period that he starts talking about, it's Davis Bitten that I'm quoting here, right? No, this was a quote from Davis Bitten, but I was using it to reinforce my case, so I guess I have to defend it. which is that I think he's talking about, he's specifically talking about, like, after the, if I remember correctly, like, after the Jubilee year. Whenever the ritualization, memorialization of the LDS past really started in earnest. And memorials were being put up and pageants started and things like that that simplified the LDS past. I mean, all groups do this, right, in some one way or another. But he's just saying that among all these monuments that were going up, right, outside of cemeteries, because I've seen the stone monuments to polygamy that exist in some of the Utah cemeteries as well, but outside of the cemeteries, right, which were the families placing the stones themselves, the church and memorial associations and things like that were not building monuments to polygamy, whereas they were building monuments to all sorts of other things, right?
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.